As I said, Sunday is the 25th year since the U.S. ratified the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. That was 1986, just to take you back in time a little bit. How has our understanding of the word genocide and the event of genocide changed over the past 25 years? Joining us now is Adam Jones, a professor of political science at the University of British Columbia and the author of Genocide, a Comprehensive Introduction. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
First of all, I wanted, you know, this United Nations Convention was actually passed by the rest of the United Nations in 1951, well before the United States ratified it. And I'm wondering if you think the definition, what we think of as genocide, the drawing line at which something becomes a genocide, has that changed since this was first accepted?
It's quite unclear in the legislation what is the requirement of a scale, for example, of an attack that qualifies as genocide. And one of the further ambiguous aspects of the convention is that if you actually look at it closely, it outlines five genocidal strategies, only one of which is physical killing of victims. It includes things like transferring children from one group to another group, preventing births within a group, and so on. So it's unfortunately one of the more ambiguous legal instruments, and the fact that nobody has been quite able to agree on the interpretation of it, I think, has led to some of the problems with its implementation over the decades.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the United States' approach to genocide has changed. First, I mean, I guess we have to put into context exactly why it took the U.S. so long to ratify this convention. Why was that?
Well, there were a number of objections raised by various parties prior to the drafting of the convention in 1948, and usually those concerns arose from a fear that the convention as an instrument could be turned around and used against them. That is the reason, for example, which political groups who were originally included in the protections of the Genocide Convention, in the end being excluded, because the Soviet Union and a number of other countries felt that the convention could then be used against them for their persecution of political groups. In the case of the United States, a lot of congressmen and others raised concerns that the convention could be used to prosecute the United States either for its treatment of indigenous peoples or for its treatment of African Americans. And indeed, the very first petition that was ever submitted to the United Nations about genocide in 1951 was by Paul Robeson and a number of other African American intellectuals in the U.S. accusing the U.S. government of genocide against African Americans. I think those concerns, combined with the broader trend of American exceptionalism, a kind of reluctance to sign on with certain international bodies and instruments, we could mention the International Criminal Court, for example, helps us to understand why the United States was so reluctant for so long.
Well, I mean, let's move a little further ahead in time. And what we're really talking about is how politically charged this word is, genocide. But further than that, the fact that by labeling something a genocide, it seems to put a responsibility immediately among other countries and other world leaders. As soon as something becomes a genocide, people are expected to act. I want you to take a listen to, this is State Department spokeswoman Christine Shelley speaking to reporters in Washington about the genocide in Rwanda.
We have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Alan, that's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
It's true that that you have specific guidance not to use the word genocide in isolation, but always to preface it with this word acts of.
I have guidance which I try to use as best as I can. There are formulations that we are using that we are trying to be consistent in our use of.
That is a spokeswoman struggling very hard to find.
It still makes one cringe every time one hears it, doesn't it?
Really, it does. And what, I mean, at what point, I mean, the drawing line between acts of genocide and genocide, was that really something that which would keep the United States from having to act in Rwanda?
No, there is no requirement of a certain number of acts that have to be in place before there is the kind of systematic pattern that would warrant the application of genocide. So that really was a very evasive framing. However, I mean, I think think it's important to recognize what was underlying that. As it happened, the debate came down to a kind of linguistic one over the Genocide Convention. But the deeper issue really was that the United States was extremely reluctant to get involved in the Rwandan genocide as a direct result of what had happened in Somalia just the year before, the whole Black Hawk Down incident. And so I do suspect that had the Genocide Convention not existed, things would have played out very similarly. There still would have been calls to intervene, and there still would have been a reluctance to do so.
Well, but that would argue that the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide is just words on the page that don't have any real-world applications.
Well, there's something to be said for that. I mean, one of the things that I focus on in my own studies is the role of norms in international affairs. And we do tend to distinguish between weakly entrenched and strongly entrenched norms. And if you looked at the norm for the prevention and suppression of genocide, one would have to acknowledge, I think, that it's a relatively weakly developed one. What I think we can say is that that word and concept and the controversies over it have proved very useful in terms of generating concern about widespread atrocities around the world, even if one does get into a big debate over definitional issues. It's quite interesting, for example, to look at the recent case, we might say, of the dog that didn't bark in the case of the secession of South Sudan from Sudan just last month. Many people, myself included, were really on tenterhooks, poised for another genocidal outbreak in that historically quite genocidal region of the world. It didn't happen. It hasn't happened so far. And the Sudanese government seems to have accepted the secession of South Sudan. I think you can look at that as a reflection of the kind of multifarious policies and sanctions and criticisms and moral opprobrium that has been visited upon that regime in part as a result of these accusations of genocide. And I think possibly in that case, we can point to them having been painted into a corner and having taken steps that they wouldn't otherwise have taken and that we can all celebrate.
Adam Jones, professor of political science at the University of British Columbia. He's author of Genocide, A Comprehensive Introduction. Today is Sunday is the 25th anniversary of the United States ratification of the United Nations Convention on Genocide. Thank you so much, Professor Jones. Coming up in just a few minutes, we have gotten in touch with the State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley. He will be here to answer questions about the U.S. diplomatic quandary in the Middle East.